Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everyone. It's your friendly neighborhood ex-Muslim Abdullah Samir here with episode 68. Now, what do we have for you today? We have the Urdu free thinker, fellow Canadian, and who is doing his activism not openly with his name, his real name, but coming in with a big splash. I mean, he's only been here a couple of months and he's already good friends with Abdullah Gondal. He already knows Sohail, my friend Reason on Faith. And his YouTube channel has, I believe, over 2,000 subscribers. So I was able to tag it. Once you hit 1,000 subscribers, you can tag it right in the title. So do check it out. Do subscribe. The point of this is to bring more people to the table and to encourage other channels to grow as well. So check out his content. We're going to have a great stream. He's going to be talking about something he has never talked about before, which is his coming out story, his origin story, his how he became the Urdu freethinker. And we were just talking a little bit off stream, and very interesting story. I'm looking forward to hearing it for the first time with you guys as well. How's it going, my friend?
It's going great. Thank you for inviting me to your show. Been a fan for a while.
Okay. Oh, yeah. So tell us how it all started. And, let's go back to, let's say, your childhood, like family and stuff like that. And, just tell us what happened and where the doubts started or if you left Islam. It sounds like you have a really interesting journey out of Islam. It wasn't just like me. It was like multiple steps, right?
Oh, yeah. It was quite a complicated journey. So I think a background is quite important into my childhood as well. Like, I come from a Muslim household, obviously, although an educated one, a Sunni Muslim family belonging to a Hanafi school of thought. And I had a pretty nomadic childhood growing up. Like, I was born in Lahore, Pakistan, but I was only 2 years old when we moved to Kenya, Africa, and I lived there for 5 to 6 years. And after that, I moved to Dubai. And just when I became a teenager, like 13, I moved to Canada. And a lot of things happened during that period of time, a lot of interesting exposures that we can go into. But background, yeah.
Kenya. I'm from Kenya too. That's amazing.
Yeah, where in Kenya?
I was born in Nairobi and my parents were born in Mombasa. So, I mean, I left when I was 8. So just like you, I don't have a lot of memories of Kenya. I mean, whatever Swahili I knew, I forgot.
So, yeah, Jambo, but I mean, Bariyaka,
that's yeah, amazing. Exactly. I know Jambo and Kwaheri, like hello and goodbye. That's about it. And then, of course, Hakuna Matata from my childhood watching Lion King, not from Kenya.
Yeah. No, there actually there. You were Ismaili, correct?
Yes.
Yeah, there was quite a lot of Ismaili community in Kenya. So yeah. We had a lot of family friends that were Ismaili, and a lot of family friends that were from Gujarat, India, like a lot of Hindus. So actually was a very enlightening experience because that was my first ever interaction with Hindus, and just. So you guys know, like as a kid, I was a little peculiar, like a 5-year-old kid. I used to be very interested in religion. My mother was a master's in history. So I got, into history and religion through that. And growing up, I was glued to like biblical stories and, watching the Ten Commandments, which is like 4-hour long movie. And my siblings used to be falling asleep. So I had a pretty peculiar taste. And we had family friends that were Hindu, and I remember sitting on a woman's lap and asking her about her gods and what kind of gods she worships. And she used to tell me that she has a statue of Krishna. And I was so indoctrinated even as a kid that I used to tell her that, my God is bigger than the universe and your God is just like 6 feet tall. But being exposed to her, she was very kind. She smiled at me, invited to her home. And she told me that they don't really worship the idol. They worship what the idol represents. And to me, like at that time, I just brushed it off. But retrospectively, when I analyze these memories, I actually, you know, in one of my videos, I actually included that about paganism and Islam, and how like Muslims bow down 5 times a day to a building made of stone, the Kaaba. And then they have the audacity to say that, well, this is not idolatry. This is different because it's the house of God. So that those kind of stories were interesting. But to really, we can go into some of the details, like in Dubai, like I found that very interesting experience. I learned Arabic over there. And I was there when 9/11 happened. And I don't know about you, if you remember what you were doing in 9/11, but I vividly remember, and I feel like a lot of people do. And I had an Arabic teacher, and they were my neighbors, and her sister knocked up in our apartment and told us that, hey, there are buildings that are on fire in the United States. And I turned on the TV, and it was like horrible. But there was a smile on that girl's face. And she said that, look, they're suspecting Muslims. You know, they're suspecting that Muslims did this because Muslims are so brave. And I was like, what are you talking about? Like, you know, the kamikazes did that as well. But yeah. I want people to realize that today we're in the phase of Islamophobia, that, you know, Islam, you can't even assert that someone, like there's an Islamic terrorist. But at mm-hmm. that time, living in the Middle East, this was the norm. Like, people used to think and sympathize with a lot of terrorists, like the Kashmiris who were fighting there, the Lashkar-e-Tayyiba, the Intifada, the second Intifada, where it was happening in 2010. I was there, and the schools were just filled with people who were sympathetic to the cause. But ironically, now we think that this is Islamophobia. But I will just summarize my journey out of Islam into 4 basic steps that we will go into detail and talk about. The first step.
Can I ask you something first?
Go ahead.
So what was your parents' relationship to you and Islam? Like, what was their expectation of you as a Muslim kid? Were they liberal? Were they like, you have to pray, you know, Juma? Like, what was the expectation of you? Did they allow you to mingle with girls and opposite sex? Or was it like, what was it? What was Islam? Did you have to go to madrasa on the weekends, or did you have to memorize Quran? What was the relationship with your family, your parents specifically?
So my family was pretty liberal in that sense. Like, I still went to a male only school. Like, it was segregated, so we did not mingle with the females, like girls at all, and dating was just not allowed. Friday prayers were mandatory, and we used to go for Friday prayers. So my even though they were quite liberal in that sense, living in a Muslim country and my parents, you know, being Pakistani, tried to enforce their faith heavily on the siblings, and including myself. So at that time, I didn't mind it, because to me, that was the right path. And, you know, I used to go, you know, for Eid prayers, for Friday prayers. And so that was not an issue. And my grandparents were actually super, super religious. Like, in fact, my great grandfather from my paternal side was a peer. I don't know. Understand, like a peer,
saint basically, right?
yeah. There's actually a shrine in the outskirts of Lahore that people actually go and tie knots and stuff, which is like ridiculous. But
do you, if you don't have to answer, do you have any sisters?
I do have an elder sister, yes.
And did she have to wear hijab in your family?
That's one thing. So my family was educated, so no, she didn't have to wear the hijab.
Lucky.
So that is definitely lucky. So the thing is that a lot of Pakistanis, like upper middle class and, you know, educated type, they don't really wear the hijab as often. I feel like it's growing now, but at that time, it wasn't the case. Like pre 9/11 and around that time, it wasn't really an issue. You know, like coming to Canada, often people find, because it's such a cultural shock, you know, I was, even though I lived in so many different places, Canada was just so diverse. Like, I never saw gay people, for instance, in my life, and I was exposed to them. And to me, well, probably saw gay people, they just weren't out of the closet. Yeah. Like, but you know,
yeah,
you know,
which shows you why we need the activism. And you know, people say, oh, why don't they keep it to themselves? But the activism is important for awareness, right? And that's why we have gay pride parades, but we don't have straight pride parades, because like by default everyone's straight, it's just assumed, right? So the existence of gay people is why we have you know, the gay pride parades, just as an aside.
Yeah. And you know, being exposed to gay people here, initially my reaction was, wow, these are the people of Lut. Like, you know, like the Sodom and Gomorrah, yeah, and all that stories, the biblical stories. The root of homophobia actually comes from those stories, and people don't realize that. Like, initially it was such a cultural shock that I became even more devout. That I became, initially in my initial phases, I became more religious. And that's when I was 13, 14. I started reading the Quran even more. I finished the Quran with translation when I was 10, but I started reading it more and more. And I finished the Bible cover to cover when I was 14. I got into comparative religions.
Wow.
In high school, I was given a platform on my law and history and religious teachers to present to the school, and you know, misconceptions about Islam and stuff. Mm-hmm. So I was pretty active about, you know, presenting Islam, and you know, that's where I found comfort. Often, a lot of immigrants, when they migrate to a new country, they often revert to what they can find and what they can cling on to as their identity, because everything is so murky. Mm-hmm. And I found myself doing the same thing, but I wasn't completely, you know, closed-minded. And, you know, when I saw these people with tattoos and, you know, a lot of, you know, gay people opening the doors for me, you know, being nice to me, I was like, they can't go to hell.
Mm. Like, can I ask, when you read the Bible, did you read like the Old Testament, New Testament? And like, just quickly, what did you think of it at the time when you read it?
Oh yeah, so I read both the Old and the New Testament. I read the King James version, and when I read, oh, yeah, and it was like such a long read.
Yeah,
like I realized how small the Quran is when I started reading the Bible.
Yeah,
actually, reading the Quran is not a big thing. It's not a big deal. You can read it cover to cover, no problem. It's not going to take you that long.
Yeah,
the Bible is an extensive encyclopedia, and I was actually quite, I didn't like the Old Testament that much, to be honest. Like I definitely the first five books, like the Torah, the Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, those five books, especially, you know, Deuteronomy and the book of Joshua that followed right after, the amount of violence that occurs in that book and mass genocide was too much. And in fact, it kind of made it seem that the God of Abraham was very tribal, extremely tribal. Like it had a favorite people, a favorite race. And in fact, even in the book of Psalms, it says, how can we sing thy praises in a foreign land? That's during the when they were outside.
Exodus?
No, they were exiled. They were exiled in Babylon.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, so they were saying the, you know, like, it seemed like Yahweh was localized as a localized entity, a localized tribal god. And that's where the concept of Holy Land came in. So at that time, I was like, this is tribal. And Islam is definitely better because Islam is universal. So, yeah, literally, I was like, this is a tribal god.
Islam is... less tribal, that's funny.
Yeah, Islam is less tribal, you know? Yeah. Islam is universal.
Yeah.
Now, obviously, retrospectively, I think that, you know, I see a lot of these apologists, to be honest, like Christian apologists. I like a lot of their videos, you know, when they criticize Islam. But honestly, when they criticize Christianity and, you know, the Bible, they're like brains fall out. Like, I really think that when they criticize Islam, they're essentially shooting themselves in the foot. It's like parents criticizing their child. Islam is the, like, the child, the progeny of these religions. Islam is a combination of the Old Testament, the fundamentalist Judaism, the tribal, with the universalism of the New Testament. To answer your question about the New Testament, though, I thought that God either had some kind of a lobectomy of his brain or some rapid personality change, had mushrooms or had some weed. Like, I don't know what happened to Yahweh that he just changed to whatever he was in the New Testament. Mm-hmm. All of a sudden, love thy enemies, go unto the Gentiles. You know, it's not restricted. You got to proselytize. But Islam is proselytizing with the fundamentalism of Judaism. You cannot get Islam without the Old Testament. It is the child of the Old Testament.
With a lot of paganism for good measure.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
sacred months and going around the Kaaba and Safa and Marwa and all of that stuff.
Oh, yeah. No, that's totally the case. Regarding the Old Testament, like, for instance, you know, the Quran doesn't really talk about stoning to death. The punishment is lashing for adultery, for zina. Mm-hmm. The Bible does. You know, the Bible, the Old Testament is mentioned stoning to death. So all the things, you know, you can argue about Muhammad having concubines. Solomon had 1,000 concubines. You know, the favorites of the Yahweh, David and Solomon, they had concubines. So when you criticize Muhammad, you got to criticize these guys too, although they're, in my opinion, fictitious. That's another thing. But Muhammad could be fictitious too. We never know.
I lean towards not. I'm more in the standard historical narrative. But then again, it's really outside of my, ability to analyze something of that depth, whether Muhammad actually existed. But there's a lot of evidence, early evidence from non-Muslim sources that Sean Anthony has written in his book, that non-Muslims actually wrote about Muhammad and his followers, and his book, I think it's called Empire of Faith, is a good reference. So yeah, I'm with that. And same thing with Jesus. If you look at Bart Ehrman versus the mythicist, I'm leaning towards the Bart Ehrman approach that Jesus did exist, but he was just a Jewish rabbi that was killed for whatever reason, and he did exist, but he wasn't obviously the Son of God. So
the narrative around Jesus is, you know, we have more eyewitnesses accounts, but in terms of Muhammad, definitely there was a prophet that started all of this, and Quran seems to be a very primary source. It seems like you're getting into someone's mind when you read the Quran. Because there was definitely a person. What I mean is that the story behind the man is rather,
reconstructed. Absolutely. Absolutely. The Muhammad of Islam, let's say Sunni Islam, not especially all Islams, but in particular what we're talking about, Sunni Islam, is a construction. It's a myth. It's what the scholars wanted us to know about Muhammad. It's whatever they decided to preserve, right? And to bring forward to today's time, right?
Totally. Yeah. That actually leads into my journey, actually, out of Islam. So, you know, I divided my journey into four different steps. As I've already alluded to, I was very religious, deeply faithful to Islam. But the first step was the rejection of the hadith. And this is actually the weakest link of Islam, which is the hadith. You know, if you read the hadith, there's a lot of ridiculous stories in it. And it's becoming more and more popular that the hadith and the sirah of the prophet by Ibn Ishaq and Hisham were made a couple centuries after the prophet. But people, I don't really know that there were a lot of scholars, they were called the Quranists, that were already, even in the 1960s in the Muslim world, were against hadith. And one of them at that time that I found very interesting was someone in Pakistan. Well, he was in Pakistan. He died in the 1980s. Is Mirza Ghulam Ahmed Parvez. And he's not Mirza Ghulam Ahmed Qadiani, which is the founder of the Ahmadiyya movement. This Parvez guy, was founder of the Tilu Islam Institute, and he was actually part of the Interior Ministry in Pakistan under the dictator Ayub Khan. And he was inspired by communism and Karl Marx. And so he was a pretty interesting guy in that sense. But he was entirely against the idea of hadith. And he presented hadith, interestingly, as a giant Persian conspiracy against Islam. And it stems from the theory, or not, well, the fact in some ways, that Bukhari and, you know, Abu Dawud, some of the hadith scholars, the collectors, were actually Persian in origin. And he noticed that the five daily prayers, for instance, comes from Zoroastrianism. So he was convinced in that sense, and he portrayed that the hadith and the whatever we know about the prophet actually was enforced under the realm of the Abbasids after the Umayyad conquest. And the Quran, for instance, only mentions three prayers by name, and the Ismailis only worship, like, only pray three times a day: the Salat al-Fajr, which is in Surah 24, verse 58, Salat al-Wusta, so the middle prayer, which is in Surah al-Baqarah 238, and Salat al-Isha, which is the night prayer, in Surah 24, verse 58. And the five daily prayers are completely Zoroastrian. And it's very interesting that people don't realize that the Umayyads were actually an Arab supremacist regime, and the Abbasids were quite religiously motivated and were installed by a general called Abu Muslim, who was Persian, and their entire government was Persian. So they were heavily influenced, and the capital was moved from Damascus to Baghdad. And a lot of the hadith and everything were collected under them. And they also undermined the Umayyad rulership. So they had stories like, you know, after the Battle of Uhud, Hinda, the wife of Abu Sufyan, ate the liver of Hamza, which is the uncle of the prophet, too. And Hinda is the mother of, you know, the Muawiyah, the founder of the Umayyad dynasty. So we have all of these political things also. So these are actually quite known, but a lot of scholars picked that up, but then they concocted this weird theory that it's a Persian conspiracy against Islam, which I bide into at that time, which is funny.
Which is interesting, because Shias also have a conspiracy that the Sunni, like Bukhari and Muslim, are the ones that, which is funny because Shias are now, the Persians are now Shia. And they say that Bukhari and Muslim and Abu Huraira and all of them conspired to praise and to raise the status of Omar, Abu Bakr, and Uthman. So they also say that. And it's so interesting that you said that hadith is the weakest link, but hadith is the bulk of Islam. Like for Sunnis, I'm saying, like, without hadith, your Islam turns into something like Buddhism, like, where it's just like, I don't even know what Islam you follow, because there's nothing, nothing left. Like, it's Quran, you can't, anyways, I don't want to get into that too much, but yeah, it's an interesting point.
Yeah. And the second step was reinterpretation of the Quran and making it more allegorical to fit with modern morality and scientific data. So as I was living in Canada, my concept of morality was evolving. And so I didn't understand when I read the Quranic passages about punishment of Noah and, you know, the people of Noah with the flood, or, you know, the people of Ad, or, you know, all these people, innocent individuals, men, women, children, being completely slaughtered by supernatural events, to me was just ridiculous. So I completely reinterpreted. And so this is my mental gymnastics phase, which a lot of Muslims are in today. And I was in that phase for about 2 years. Like, I interpreted the punishment of nations as rise and fall of civilization. So if you're not good to your people, you eventually lead to calamity and disaster. And often, like, if you read the Bible, you actually kind of go through some of the passages of, you know, the people of Israel, like the Israelites were not being so good, and then they were conquered by better people, like Babylonians and so forth. So that's how it kind of justified that these are all allegorical, metaphorical things. Adam and Eve, well, that's potentially could be evolution, because Adam is just a normal person. You know, like, it's a general term for all humanity. And science and Islam, obviously, everyone goes through that phase, in my opinion. It's so easy to fall into that. And I started interpreting miracles differently. So, you know, like the miracles of Jesus, like bringing dead back to life is metaphorical. A lot of Christians do that as well. So I got that from them, I would say. You know, Moses throwing staff and becoming snakes is a metaphor of Moses having, like, you know, debate with the priests of Egypt. And, you know, he defeated them in like a debate. Like, this is the kind of things that were going in my brain. But the amount of stress it took, I want people to realize that it's so much easier to stop doing all these mental gymnastics. You are essentially making up your mind and you're imposing your will on the Quran. Rather, just read the Quran. It's that simple. It was exhausting.
Yeah, I want to just stop here and kind of emphasize this point that the reason why you had to go through all this, and correct me if I'm wrong, is because you were, like, just to put it bluntly, you were indoctrinated into Islam. And as your intelligence was increasing and you're not necessarily just intelligence, but as you mature, you become more intelligent and your understanding of the world was growing, you were stuck with this thing that was day by day more and more out of like place with reality. With
totally.
The accumulation of knowledge around you, with everything that you knew, you had this little funny place in the back of your mind that was like clashing, right? And I can see from the way that you're analyzing things and the way that you're reading books, like the holes probably started to appear early on, and you started to see like contradictions. So the only way to keep it real is to start creating, you know, having this sort of, you know, mental gymnastics, let's call it that, in order to make it cohere, because it's incoherent, right? And that mirrors the same experience I had, except it was not as young as you. For me, I only became scientifically literate, if you want to call it that, later on in life, you know, like basically in my 30s, you could say, which is when I left Islam. But as a Muslim, I didn't see those contradictions. But for you, you were like clashing into them early on. So you started taking the steps to fix it, because that's what the mind tries to do when it has doubts. People say, you know, you shouldn't have doubt. I mean, Muslims say you shouldn't have doubts. The doubts is your mind telling you something is wrong. It's like an alarm bell. Hey, what is going on here? Things are not clicking, right? And so you try to fix that. You don't ignore it.
Yeah, totally.
It, which is what you did, right? And that's a sign of your intelligence and your deep thinking, that you were doing all of these things in order to try to solve the problem and also maintain, you know, the pre-existing structures that were created in your mind very early on.
Yeah. So when you have, you really summarized that really well. That's exactly how I felt. When you're confronted with new facts, you have two choices. You can either cherry pick your religion, you can ignore the verses and move on, or you can really try to make it all work together. And I really sincerely tried to make it all work together. I really wanted to believe in the Quran. I really wanted to believe in the afterlife. The fact that, you know, I'm going to see my grandfather in heaven, that was very comforting to me. Like, I wanted to, because I was very close to him and I couldn't see him for like a while. And he unfortunately passed away when I had, you know, plans to see him before that. So the fact that, you know, I could see him, this is comforting. I really sincerely wanted to believe in it. And I wanted to make every verse matter, because this is the word of God. Every verse must either stand or it must all fall. I couldn't cherry pick. So it was just very, very exhausting for me. Like, there were times when I used to be reading up, like, and I'm a high school student, remember, like, I used to be reading late into the night. I was looking at all these books. So it was very exhausting experience. And I feel a lot of people are actually also very exhausted, but they just need to realize that you just have to let the book speak for itself.
Yeah. And you made another very good point in reflection there, which is we are emotional beings, and we evolved, you know, with religion alongside of us. And we evolved with a tendency to believe in these things, even if it's not true. I mean, people have to realize that just because it feels right doesn't necessarily make it true, right? Just because you want it to be true, just because you want to meet your grandfather or your mother, and I'm sorry to hear that you didn't get to say goodbye. I mean, that's really sad. You know, it, and some people, and people deal with that, you know, thing in different ways, but I'm glad you were able to overcome all this.
Yeah, I mean, like you have to. And at the end of the day, like you either make things work or it just falls apart. And for me, it just all fell apart.
Yeah.
That the the third step after, you know, like after I did that was de-ritualizing Islam completely. So I actually had this weird phase in which I started thinking of Islam in a more political sense rather than, because Islam is a political philosophy. It's not just a religion. But I started de-ritualizing Islam because I was exposed to more and more science. And I was like, okay, these rituals don't make sense. So I really, you know, started looking at some scholars that talked about a different meaning of the word salat, which is, you know, the namaz, or, you know, to pray five times a day. And one verse, which I don't know, just for interest's sake, that some people can go into if they're you know, I don't know, bored and want to look into it, that it's the verse, chapter 22, verse 41, that talks about that الَّذِينَ إِن مَكَّنَّاهُمْ فِي الْأَرْضِ أَقَامُوا الصَّلَاةَ وَأَطَوَى الزَّكَاةَ. That means when we establish those people as in believers on the land, then they establish salat and like prayer, and they give charity. So I interpreted the verse or this word salat as to follow and to establish God's law on earth, not to pray five times a day. And, you know, aqamu means to establish. So that's how I understood it. And, you know, it also required a lot of mental gymnastics. I looked at the lexicon. And there, so the root word for this is sod, lam, and waw. And one of them is sod, lam, and alif maksura. It's one of the words there, which means refers to a horse that's following. So I thought, okay, this means to follow. So this means to essentially to establish, you know, and that in the context of this verse, to me, that made sense. But at the same time, you know, it's no different from, you know, people interpreting verses differently, like, you know, the beating of the wife is the idribuhunna doesn't mean to beat your wife. It means something else. So it was exactly the same thing that I was doing. I reinterpreted Ramadan into something completely different as well. It's really like a lot of Ahmadis also reinterpret the word khatam, for instance, you know, like khatamun nabiyyin means the seal of the prophets. But a lot of Ahmadis say, well, it means the best of the prophets, because khatam can mean a ring. And, you know, looking at the Quran into the context, when Quran says, khatam Allahu ala qulubihim, that God has put seals in their hearts, it's not putting like a diamond ring in their hearts. It's not putting some kind of a beautiful ring or something, you know, nice on their hearts. So it's just another form of mental gymnastics. But the fourth step was a reinterpretation of the concept of God itself. I made God more and more limited, restricted, and smaller. And essentially, that's because there's so much suffering in the world. Earthquakes, death, disease, morbidities, and so on. And if God is all-powerful, why does he cause this? And if he doesn't do anything to prevent this, isn't he guilty just by association? So naturally, I had to change the concept of God and make him restricted to his own laws that he created, that he just formed the laws, the fundamental laws of physics, and allowed the universe to come into existence, but he didn't interfere. Now, obviously, this is completely deviant from Islam. So the amount of mental gymnastics that I had to do was incredible.
Yeah, indeed.
So essentially at this stage, I became somewhat of a pseudo deist, because I still believed in the scripture. So people who don't know what a deist is, so a deist is someone that believes in a higher power, but he doesn't believe that that higher power interferes in his creation in any way, or interferes in a form of revelation. So I call myself here pseudo-deist because I still believe that the Quran is a scripture of God.
Oh yeah.
But I still didn't really think that he interfered, which obviously is a paradox, right? So the natural step was, in a few months, a year, I will come to question the idea of a revelation. Like, why is God whispering in someone's ear? This dude, someone special, he can reveal himself. He could tell everyone, you know, guide humanity. And if he's not interfering, why to this one particular individual? Why isn't that a form of interference? Yeah. I could not solve that. And that's where I completely decided to leave Islam.
Oh, wow. And you were how old at this time?
I was 18, 18, 19. Oh, wow. Yeah.
So this was like over a decade ago.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah, not over the decade. Yeah, about a decade, I guess, right?
Yeah. And then I, then eventually I just became an atheist, you know, then obviously around that time, that was around the peak time of, you know, Richard Dawkins coming out, you know, this was like 2000, like 18, you know, like, sorry, 2008. So yeah, you know, Richard Dawkins coming out and stuff. So like, I read The God Delusion as well, and that really made me from a deist to someone who's like an agnostic and an atheist. And I feel like, you know, Christopher Hitchens and the God and Richard Dawkins did a great job for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Wow, what a story. Yeah, and it just shows that, you know, as Muslims will say, those who Allah guides, nobody can misguide, I guess. but I mean, it shows that, you know, those were seeking and, you know, sincere and able to overcome the brainwashing, the childhood indoctrination, those people will find their way out of Islam eventually if, you know, they keep at it. And that's what's happening. I mean, you know, you definitely beat the curve for most of us. You've been an ex-Muslim a lot longer than me. And so now you're coming and you're making content, which is amazing. I'm happy to see that. What motivated you to come out publicly now after all this time? I mean, left Islam so long ago. Why are you talking about it now?
So when I came out, initially I had a bit of backlash. So as an 18-year-old, I believe, like, you know, my family was very aware of, you know, my, you know, that I read a lot, I'm into scripture. So they actually had really high hopes for me that this guy is like, you know, wow, he knows the Quran. Yeah, exactly.
That's high hopes for you to become a, like, imam or something?
No, not really. But like the fact that, you know, that I know the scripture very well. Like, they obviously knew that I wanted to be a doctor even early on. And they knew that, you know, that this is me, like, I'm studious in that sense.
Yeah.
But they, like, the fact that I was so passionate about Islam and about religion and about the concept of God and all, like, theology in general, that they actually had high hopes that this person, you know, like, you know, whenever we had family over, family discussions, we had like intellectual conversations. So the fact that when I came out that, hey, I don't believe in this at all, from like completely, because they didn't really see my inner struggles. They saw my outer face that I tried to present everyone. Whereas in my inside, my brain was full like of debates and it was a horrible place to be. But outside, I tried to present it like I'm a staunch Muslim and this is the right path. And inside, it was just, I was tearing myself to shreds. And it was just a very stressful and it was just very time consuming. Like, I could have done so much if I hadn't done that. Like, I could have learned a musical instrument. one of my biggest regrets, actually.
You know, and that's one of the reasons I offered my kids. I said, once, now that they don't have to memorize Quran, I'm like, hey, you guys don't have Quran class anymore. Do you want to do a musical instrument? one of my kids did piano, and then he did guitar, and, you know, he kind of dropped out with that now. But I'm hoping that, and one of my other sons does digital music. He likes making music on the computer, so it's good. It's something else to do, you know, because the Quran is just like Muhammad's poetry, Muhammad's words. What's the point of memorizing that? Where's the value in that? It's when you put it at a high level and you say this is God's words, and of course everybody thinks that this is the best thing since Swiss cheese and it has to be memorized, or since sliced bread. But if it's just Muhammad's poetry, then like, what's the point? I mean, we can study it. We can study in a school or whatever for those who are interested. But to make millions and millions of kids, you know, have to memorize it, I mean, it's just pointless, right? It's just a waste of humankind's potential.
No, totally. And the fact that it's being imposed as a religious law in form of like constitutions in Islamic republics, that is a deep problem. For me, that's the biggest problem. But to answer your question, why, like initially I faced a bit of backlash, and my parents were deeply upset to the point, like my dad, especially, my mom stopped talking to me.
So you told them?
Yeah. I told them. Like I believe in like honesty, like with my parents. So I like told them immediately that, hey, wow. I'm out. Yeah. So that's the difference. Like, you know, like I just told them. A lot of people decide to keep it secret for the right reasons, honestly, because I went through quite a bit of pain in that time, and my mom stopped talking, and she just didn't talk to anyone for like, she was in severe depression for like 2 to 3 months. And my dad used to call me that, you know, like there was a lot of emotional, I wouldn't want to say abuse because I know, yeah, like, you know, it was just the fact that guilt, you know, guilt tripping, that it's because of you that, you know, mom has stopped talking. And I was almost like my dad was like so upset that he just didn't want to like support me anymore. Like he didn't want to like pay for like my college or anything. It was just like, you know, I'm going to back off. But then like that was in his anger, but it's like a few weeks later and like a month later, he came back. After that, so I was very grateful that, you know, humanity prevailed in my family. Like like the love for the child prevailed over dogma. Eventually now we had the ceasefire agreement. So essentially, I'm not going to talk about Islam. Like I'm not going to proselytize people outside of Islam. And for this long period of time, we had this agreement that I will not go on social media. I'm just going to, you know, mind my own business. And that's what I did. You know, that's exactly what I did. But what happened was I also felt kind of suffocated because they, during that period of time, no one was stopping them from, you know, doing their religious functions. No one was stopping them from, you know, advocating for giving money to mosques and supporting their own causes. Like they started reading or listening to Ghamdi, which recently, I don't know if you know, he's a Pakistani or Indian scholar who now has launched a crusade against atheism, and he has this guy Hamza Ali Abbasi, who's now a staunch. He was a, I don't know, an atheist.
He's become a da'i now, right?
Yeah. He's a Pakistani actor that's now, you know, good-looking guy. He's become a poster boy, you know, for anti-atheist crusade. Although the Islam of Ghamdi and, you know, Hamza Ali Abbasi is very, very mild. But it enables theocracy. They still believe in the establishment of Islamic law.
Mm-hmm.
What I just couldn't, and my family actually knows them, and they actually they know Hamza Ali Abbasi personally, and they, so to me, supporting them was hey, you guys broke the ceasefire agreement. that was one that, I mean. But I was here and there. I was actually writing on platforms. Like I'm not going to say who I am, but I'm a part-time columnist. Mm-hmm. So I write for the newspapers in Canada. So I, you know, like Mashal Khan, and you know, like there were a lot of things, lynching and blasphemy laws. So I'm a very. I used to write against those things. So indirectly, I used to target Islam, but I never overtly said Islam by itself is the root of the problem. I said interpretations of Islam is bad. I used to write in my articles, you know, this blasphemy law is like, you know, plaguing the Muslim world. Theocracies are plaguing the Muslim world. But this is the time when I decided to say, hey, there's a lot of things going on. And in fact, right now, there's a huge momentum, you know, looking at Apostate Prophet, you know, Gondal and everyone coming out. And there's a huge momentum on our side. And I said, now or never, right? Like, this is the time where you actually need to support this community. And I've been like sitting there watching you guys, you know, just, you know, I'm supporting you guys, obviously, but it's great to be actually involved.
I mean, that is great. And what a story. So what I want to ask you is, you know, this whole thing about your mom and your dad and how they got, you know, your mom was depressed. How much of this was, do you think, like, was this actually trying to make you change your way and become religious again? Is that what it was?
It was exactly that. So they, like, especially I would say my dad, he definitely was saying that, look, even if you didn't believe in God anymore, you know, if I was like that, if I stopped believing in God, I would fake it. I would, you know, just pray for my parents or, you know, go to social gatherings. So essentially he was advocating that I should rather fake it. And it's crazy. It's actually crazy to not see that, hey, so I remember asking him, what if like someone in a Hindu household decided to become a Muslim? Mm-hmm. Would you tell that person to then fake it, go to the mandir, you know, say Hare Krishna, and, you know, like, you know, just do everything holy and, you know, celebrate Diwali? Or will you advocate for that person to actually practice what he believes in?
Yeah, and exactly, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's so hypocritical.
And he said he would advocate for that person to practice what he believed in?
Yeah, so at that, like, he didn't have an answer to that. Like, exactly. So so having a dialogue like that with my family really helped the cause that, hey, they started accepting me, that, you know, this, you know, he was an atheist. Still hurts them to, you know, admit that, you know, he's an atheist. Still hurts them, but it's still, you know, they, you know, my relationship with my family is like very, on a very good setting now, I would say. But, go ahead.
Your family, so what I've found is with more liberal families, this is what happens. Like, my family is more liberal as well. And so they were okay eventually with me. I mean, in my case, it was okay in general from the very beginning, because my family is very liberal and was not religious at all. And I was the one that became religious. But I've heard this I've seen this happen over and over again, where people are in liberal families, they don't really like the fact that you leave Islam, but eventually they kind of come to terms with it, which is why we want to keep doing this activism, and we want people to become less religious. Even people that are Muslim, I mean, the goal is not necessarily always for people to leave Islam, maybe just to have a little bit of doubt, just to, you know, question a little bit, so that they don't, you know, dive deep into the religion in a way that they throw away things that, you know, they can't go back on. You know, for example, like dropping out of school or not even going to university and going to study Islam, that type of decision can, or like going for jihad, right? That type of decision could be one that you can't go back from. If you ever go to, if you join like some group overseas, there's really no walking back from that. And, you know, you might eventually, like, there was one guy that emailed Abdullah Gondal and us and me, and he was in Syria, and he was like, I want to come back now. And, you know, I don't believe in this stuff anymore. And it's like,
wow.
Okay, well, we'll try to connect you with the, you know, the authorities and see if they can make a case or whatever. But like, there's a certain line. Once you cross it, you can't go back. It's not always that extreme. Mm-hmm. I mean, we don't know for sure what the guy really believes. I mean, he seemed like a sincere guy. That's kind of like the most extreme example. There's examples of people like Yasir Qadri as well, like people that the scholars that, like, do you have examples like that from your life? People that you know that they kind of like dove deep into Islam and now it's going to be even more difficult if they wanted to leave it. What do you think about that?
So I feel that, you know, like my brothers, for instance, they're kind of trapped in that sense, because they're very loyal to my parents. They're elder. They're also, you know, physicians, and they have children. And I see them as, if they leave Islam, they essentially are, they don't really have a choice. Like their wives are very religious. You know, their in-laws are very religious. When you're that bogged down, you want to, there is literally no incentive for you to change. That is very important for people to understand that if you have social ties that bind you to a particular ideology, like your entire life, your identity, in terms of Yasir Qadhi, that is his identity. He has made now a living out of it. Like this is, he is that person. So for him to change, there's literally no incentive. And I don't see him changing in the future either. I think that it's a lost cause in those cases. They're very rare circumstances that people like that change.
That's a good point. I mean, there's just too many things weighing in your favor, and in favor of staying as a Muslim, especially considering the fact that if you become atheist and you stayed Muslim, you don't like it doesn't make a difference at the end of the day, right? Whereas the other way around, if you're atheist and Islam is true, you can't just like, it makes more sense to go towards a religion, right? Even if you lose everything in this world. But if you're an atheist, you're like, you know, closet atheist, agnostic, skeptic, like Yasir Qadhi knows all of the points, right? He knows all of the arguments and the responses to them. So either he's somehow made peace with them somehow, or he's just riding the wave and, you know, continuing on the bandwagon. Like, I mean, he's probably minting it. Like, he's, I know Noman Ali Khan's institute is multi-million dollar institute. Yakin is a multi-million dollar institute. Al Maghrib is probably multi-million dollar institute as well. So, like you said, why would he give that all up? You know, the Hajj tours are so lucrative. I mean, there's so many things in his favor as a Muslim. Like, it just, it would, he would lose everything, right? Yeah. A couple of people are asking if you were told to speak to a sheikh, to talk to the Molvi, and what happened.
So that's the irony, right? So initially, like, as growing up as a kid, wow, this kid knows so much about Islam. Wow, he's like, he knows like so much about other religions, about the Bible. He knows things by heart. And then I reject Islam. Oh, he doesn't know anything. He needs, oh my God, he needs to go see a scholar. He needs to, you know, like, I'm like, wow, like, what is going on? Like, it's like one of the tweets, I think, by Gondalar. I think it was you who actually, yeah, that, you know, in order to accept Islam, you don't need to know anything, but to leave Islam, you need a PhD in Arabic studies, which is kind of ironic because I did take Arabic in university. I actually did I obviously in bachelor's I was doing sciences, but in my electives I did Arabic. And you don't really I really want to talk about this topic because this is very dear to me. It's very personal. So you don't really need to speak Arabi. You don't. You don't need to speak Arabic to leave Islam. Yeah. Now, no one speaks Fusha. No one speaks Fusha. The Arabs speak different dialects. There are like the Khaliji dialect. There's the Bilad al-Sham, which is the Syrian dialect. There's the Misri dialect. There's so many different dialects. And the Moroccan dialect, the Maghribi dialect, the people don't even understand it. So it's that different. Fusha is the classical Arabic, the modern standard Arabic. Now you can learn that. Now you may not be eloquent in speaking it. Certainly not a lot of people are, but you can take courses if you want and learn the basic Arabic grammar. It's not going to take long. It's going to take like three courses. There's beginner, intermediate, and advanced. You can take it from any universities. Continuing Studies University of Toronto offers that. You can take it. And when you read the Quran, if you're that interested, you can actually understand the grammar. So when people say that, oh, you need to speak Arabi, that's complete nonsense because you don't need to. You just need to understand it. There are plenty of Orientalists who take Arabic studies. They don't speak Fusha. It's not like they're practicing Fusha daily. But when they read a passage, there's a different type of linguistic ability the brain has. So your brain is very amazing. You have the, you know, the Broca's area that you need to train to, you know, say things. But then there are other areas of the brain to really understand and comprehend information. So like, for instance, my parents also speak Punjabi. Now I'm not that great at speaking Punjabi, but I can understand whatever they're saying, like completely. So that is a very bad and intellectually dishonest approach. So again, so that's that's one thing. So I think that going back to your
can I say something about that? Yeah, about the Arabic. At the end of the day, Arabic is a language that has symbols in it, and the symbols have meaning. So if you're saying, if somebody's saying that these symbols cannot be converted into another format, that doesn't make any sense, because when you have people becoming Muslim after reading the penguin, like one of the converts I know in real life from university, he read the penguin version of the Quran. I don't even know what the translator was. It wasn't Yusuf Ali even. It was just some random translation of the Quran. And he read it. And I like this. And I became Muslim. And I don't know how he became Muslim from that. But anyways, there was other things going on in his life too. But if that's enough to become Muslim, then that should be enough to leave Islam based on that as well. Now, if people like Yusuf Ali spent a major part of their life learning Arabic, and you know, he made it his life project to translate the Quran. And it's not a one-to-one translation, meaning that it's his interpretation, of course. But like when there's one word, it's possible that it might be multiple words in English. It's possible it might not be a perfect one-to-one translation, but you can still get the idea, or you can explain it. I mean, when you learn Arabic, that's how you learn it. You're learning that this word means this thing. And of course, it's not always one-to-one, but you get the point, you get the idea. And then when you look at the context of the sentence, you understand that this means this in this context. So it's really a way of trying to make the Quran unfalsifiable.
Yeah, I totally agree.
That all they want to do, what they want to do is they want to make it unfalsifiable, and they want to use this. But there's many people who speak Arabic and leave Islam as well. And there's many Arab non-Muslims. Just knowing Arabic is not like, you know, but the thing is, you know, Muslims are sold this lie that the Quran's Arabic is so amazing that people became Muslim just because of the Arabic language, just because of the eloquence. And, you know, they tell you the Sahaba, this Sahaba, that Sahaba was so impressed, and Omar was so impressed, or whatever. And so they just accept it. They must be, right? Which is why I think there's a point where when people leave Islam, they just can't believe it, because they from their paradigm, how can anyone leave Islam? Because either you are not a proper Muslim, or maybe you just don't understand Islam. You need to talk to the Sheikh, or you need to get your brain checked, or whatever. Right? You have some mental issue or something. I can be told that as well. What do you say to people that say that, you know, you need to stick with it? You need to really just like you have doubts. They always call it doubts. It's never like. The point is, there's a certain point where your doubts become certainty, right? Like the amount of doubts you have become more than your confidence in the belief system. And at that point, it's no longer doubts. Now you have doubts about Islam being true. You don't have doubts about it being false. You're at the point where you have so much, you know, and that's why when people actually ask me what, you know, if they think I'll ever go back to Islam, and I just don't understand how that's possible when the accumulation of knowledge is so much against the Quran. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So your question is what exactly in this regard? Like,
what would you say to someone that says you need to stick with it?
Stick with the Islam. Oh my God.
Work it out. Don't give up. You know, like the Jannah is coming. Like in my case, I was told, oh, you did all these good deeds. You created verse by verse Quran and light upon light. I feel so sorry for you. You just threw away all your good deeds.
Yeah, I mean that stems from a point of ignorance, really. Like there is the Quran is completely not. In terms of scientific facts, in terms of historical facts, it's not standing the test of time. You can go into the very details of the Quranic stories. Like I will have future videos on, you know, Moses and the historicity of like different prophets. And these are legends that the Quran presents as a historical fact. Then in terms of science, the Quran, you know, we have all these, you know, Harun Yahya and Zakir Naik and all these people trying to, like, in this bandwagon that the Quran is compatible with science. It's not. It's really, really not. I actually find it so embarrassing that I even considered the embryology of the Quran. Like, now that I've learned, I did a master's in stem cell biology, and I was like, wow, okay, I can't believe. And look, go back to that verse. I'm like, wow, Christ, what was wrong with me? Like, So it's just that, like, there's no going back now. To me, Islam doesn't even, it's hard for, I sympathize with Muslims. It's hard for them to understand how can someone leave Islam, and are they just want to have sex and they want to have fun and do drugs now? Like, is that what it is? But for me, I really wanted to believe in Islam. I really wanted to, but for me, it doesn't evoke any emotion whatsoever. For me, when I think of Islam, I think of, like, when I think of Allah, I think of like Zeus or Anubis or any other god that humans made up. So that's like, there's no way going back now.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, it's interesting. Your story reminds me of Sohail, my friend Sohail Ahmed, A Reason on Faith, and how he was one of the up and coming youth members in the Ahmadiyya Masjid. He was known as the scholarly guy, the guy that, you know, was, you know, not only helping out with the blood donor clinics and all that, and running them, not helping out, sorry, running them. And he was also the guy that, like, was studious on Islam and ended up leaving Islam and went from the guy that you talk to that everyone respects for his knowledge and, you know, his parents are always being praised, your son is so knowledgeable on Islam, to like, oh, this guy doesn't know anything. Like, and to, you know, he wrote a book, which is interesting. And they actually told him to, they made him kind of put away the books and not give them out. He was going to give out these books, but he had like all of these questions he had compiled and all of these issues. And like you said, the Ahmadis have their own way of reconciling things where they don't take a lot of the things literally that Sunnis would take. They reject like tons of hadith that Sunnis are stuck with. So they have a different approach out of it. But yeah, your story definitely reminds me of that. And, you know, I'm happy to hear that you were able to make your way out of this world thing. Now, before we take questions and, comments, I want to tell everyone that I'm speaking to the Urdu Freethinker. He's a fellow Canadian like myself. Do check out his channel. It's linked right in the title. So right now, whoever's watching, there's over 100 of you, click on the title. Go and subscribe to his channel, and you know, he's gonna have more interesting content. A big video, I think, a series you're gonna do on Moses.
Yeah.
Did you do one on embryology as well? Because that sounds like,
yeah, it's coming up. Of course, it awesome. Is. Okay.
beautiful. So, looking forward to that. I've subscribed myself, and for those of you who are listening to the podcast on your iTunes or Stitcher, whatever app you're using, please do leave a review. And we want to get in the top 100. I want to get this podcast in the top 100 for Islam, next to Mufti Menk and Zakir Naik and Noan Ali Khan. We want people to look up Islam podcast and see the Abdullah Samir podcast and listen to these amazing stories of people leaving Islam. You know, I'm doing great on YouTube, you know, 50,000 subscribers. I'm really grateful for that. But now we got to reach more people that are, you know, different formats that we had that are becoming podcasting is becoming really popular. So we want to reach people in the ways that are most convenient for them. So please do leave a review. If you're new to the channel and you're listening on YouTube, please do subscribe, leave a thumbs up and all that. And if you want, you can always join the channel and support me financially. The financial support definitely helps. It helps me to continue doing more such videos. We have lots of big plans, you know, videos like this, which are like over an hour long. You don't always get to watch the whole thing. So I want to make clips out of it, upload the most interesting parts for people to, you know, there's a lot of like bang moments in this conversation that I'm like, this would make a great video on its own and people are going to miss it because it's part of a longer video. So the money is needed to continue to do such things. So I greatly appreciate it if you join. Thank you for that. Now, going back to your story, what would you say is your advice to people that are, let's say, facing doubts, people that are listening to your content, young men and women that know or that have some, you know, have some questions now? They've listened to your story, they listened to my story, and they're starting to wonder, like, what would you suggest to them? What advice would you give them?
I would tell them to really keep an open mind. And honestly, religion is religion. Like, you can be a Muslim, okay? You can be a Muslim as long as you're a good person. Be good to your fellow human beings. Don't try to impose your views on someone else. Don't try to have a theocratic regime in Canada and try to impose like your laws here. And don't try to do that. Look, if you want to believe in Islam, I totally understand. I am sympathetic. I wanted to do that. If you want to believe in the afterlife, if you want some kind of a structure, and it's, you know, too hard for you to, you know, read different philosophers, I understand the incentives for a lot of people to do that. But if you ever have, if you have doubts, don't try to impose your own views on the Quran. Just read the Quran, read the scriptures, read the hadith. And if you still find it appealing, well, I can't really help you. But as long as you're intellectually honest about it, you need to ask yourself this question: am I being intellectually honest? Are these my opinions, or are these the opinions of the Quran? Are these my 21st century moral values, or are these the actual opinions of the Quran? Is this wishful thinking? Is this what the Quran is actually saying? So those are the questions I would say are very, very important. At the end of the day, you don't really need to read the Quran. You can just live your life as long as you're a good person, good human being, kind to your fellow humans. You know, if you're just a nominal Muslim, that's fine too. There are a lot of nominal Christians. And I think that, you know, in the future, I think a lot of people are just either going to leave Islam, or they're just not going to, they're just going to identify it as a form of identity. And I see that in the future, to be honest. So that's essentially my advice, because that's what I see happening.
Awesome. Awesome. So if you still have a bit of time, we can take some questions.
Sure. Sure. Yeah.
All right. Okay. So one of the questions is being asked: what would you do if Muslim apologists are responding to you? If they refute you, would you? Are you interested in a back and forth type of thing, or are you just going to make your own thing?
So this is where I'm glad this question is asked, because, as I've said, people like Yasir Qadi and, you know, Muhammad Hijab, who's extremely obnoxious, they've made a living. There's no incentive for them to change. Now, you can debate them. Now, the debates, problem with the debates is that it's very egocentric. It becomes about the person and not about the topic.
Yeah.
If you're a loud individual, and people like Muhammad Hijab, what they do is that they bring people down to their dirty level, and then they just like, it's like debating Donald Trump. Okay, are you really going to debate Donald Trump? Do you think you'll have an intellectual discourse with Donald Trump? No, you're not. It's just an ego contest. So yeah, at the end of the day, my channel, what my goal is to provide an educational resource for non-Muslims and Muslims. I want Muslims to feel approachable to my channel too. And I try to use professional and polite language, and try to have less of my, although my opinions come forth, obviously, but I try to provide more facts and have like 10% of my own personal opinions to it. I don't want it to be too didactic. Mm-hmm. So I don't believe in that. I don't believe in, My parents actually tell me to actually talk to Ghamdi one-on-one. Mm-hmm. They actually tell me that, you know, and they say, you know, if you debate with Ghamdi and you actually, we see the value in your argument, then we will believe you, you know? I was like, look, Dad, you're a good person. I have no reason, like, you're not going around killing people.
I don't care, basically, if you want.
I don't care.
I have no problem with that, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's the thing some people don't get is, I mean, I'd say the more reasonable ones of us, we don't care if you're Muslim. I mean, that's not the point of this. I think that other people that are like very hardline anti-theists that want everyone to become non-Muslim, I don't really care. I mean, you can be Muslim or not Muslim, but as long as you respect my rights and, you know, my boundary, my personal boundaries are that your religious beliefs and your practices are to you, and they're not going to be pushed onto anybody else, right? So as long as that is being held under secularism, then we're all good. So next question, and thank you for the super chat, yeah. Pete. Your thoughts on the religious reformation. Is it an alternative / necessary evil to what's currently available, or best to be rid of religion altogether?
Yeah, so The problem with religious reformation, I think it's definitely happening. So the fact that what you're seeing, Ghamdi, and you know, people like Hamza Ali Abbasi, and you know, the Quranists, the Hadith rejectors, these are all signs of reform. Whether this is a necessary evil, I think it's just it's an eventuality. Let's just put it that way. So it happened in Christendom in the early 17th century. Like, the Newtonian God was very deistic. Like, he just basically formed the universe and he didn't really interfere. So that's the kind of God that we will find in the Islamic world very soon. A deistic kind of God that doesn't really interfere in the universe whatsoever. Yeah. Yeah. And in a way, that is better than what we have today, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Are you? You're not deist, though. You're atheist.
Oh yeah, yeah. I'm an atheist.
A lot of people misunderstand the difference between agnostic and atheist. Do you want to just talk about that before I take on the next question? That's a question from me. What's the difference? Why do you call yourself atheist? Are you actually not agnostic?
Yeah. So the idea.
Are you arrogant? Are you so arrogant that you have to, you know, for sure there's no God?
Yeah. So the idea of agnostic is someone who would say, hey, look, I don't know if there's a God out there, so I cannot be sure. Whereas an atheist says, I know in terms of probability that there is no God. Now, the issue is that how do you define God? That's the fundamental question. So when I say I'm an atheist, of an intellectual creator, an intelligent creator of the universe, that something complicated created something so simple, like four fundamental laws of physics, and that's it. So as Richard Dawkins puts it, like, you created a giant jumbo jet, like the paradox, to solve something really, really simple. I believe in things evolving from simplicity. So yes, there is a point of origin. I don't think it's a creative, like a creator, an intelligent creator. And I am, in terms of probability, I would put my bets that there's a high probability that the creator is not intelligent. Now, so it really depends on how you define yourself. So yes, we are not sure of the point of the origin of the universe. Now, in that sense, I'm an agnostic because I don't know what happened, right? Yeah. But to Zeus, I'm an atheist. To Allah, I'm an atheist. Yeah. So that's.
And I would add that, at least in my case, and I'll ask you about you as well, like, I'm an agnostic atheist in the sense that I'm what's called the weak atheist on the Dawkins scale, meaning that I am skeptical that there is a God. I mean, I'm skeptical that no God exists. I highly doubt that there is a God, you know, whatever you want to call it, whatever, by God, again, what does God mean, right? Like, it depends on the definition of God. Obviously, the Abrahamic God, the Muslim God,
the Allah, tribal God,
exactly, doesn't, for sure doesn't exist. Some power of the force or something like that, maybe. So from that perspective, I think 99% of atheists are actually agnostic. The agnostic atheists, very few people are what you call strong atheists, meaning that the 100% confident that there is no God whatsoever of any sort. I'd say and like Dillahunty talks about this as well. And, you know, it's a much strong, the weak atheism position is much stronger. It's much easier to defend than strong atheism. If you start from weak atheism, the burden of proof is on you to prove that God exists. If you start from strong atheism, there is no God, then that's a harder proposition to kind of demonstrate, like, logically or,
totally,
or whatever, right?
Yeah. So in terms of God, like, do you define God as some kind of an intelligence or like any?
Yeah. So that's what I'm not convinced, right? I'm not deist, I'm atheist as well, but I'm saying, but I am okay with the idea of deism, but I don't ascribe intelligence to God. I think if there is a power of the force behind the universe, it would be maybe what the Hindus called, I don't know if they call it Atman or something, an idea of like a power, like a giant jellyfish or a tree or something. Not, I mean, I'm just using analogies here, obviously not tree. Tree is a creation, a jellyfish is a creation. But just like, you know, something that's like without any sort of empathy or feeling or desire or intent. It's just a power that creates and creates, and you know what I mean? Like a
totally
like yeah. a like a like
it doesn't
a
power have human power. Emotions. It's not
yeah, like, yeah. And yeah, it doesn't yeah. like we are completely like, you know, when people say God must have had a purpose for creating us, I'd say we're as irrelevant to this God, if he does exist, as like ants. I mean, ants are even more relevant to us because we interact with ants. But like that, you know, because we, I do believe that we are a cosmic accident of sorts. Even if there is a God, which I don't believe there is a God, but even if there is a God, I don't believe that God intentionally made us, because all evidence points to the fact that we're an accident of sorts. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's just, it just happened. It just happened to be that we evolved from simpler life forms, and maybe there's more universes. So I do think that, like you said, I don't know what you were quoting. You said, was it Dawkins that said it's like you invented this big,
yeah.
What was that phrase you used?
So the jumbo jet.
Yeah.
The ultimate jumbo jet. Yeah.
What was the phrase? You invented a jumbo jet to explain something simple?
Something simple. Yeah. Something simple. Yep.
I'm
so paraphrasing it, obviously.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that analogy. There's a couple more questions. One of them was saying about Pakistan. What do you think? Okay, here it is. How can Pakistan exist without the Islamic narrative as a unifying force?
Oh man. Okay. So that's absolutely. So Islam is an experiment, right? I mean, the Pakistan is an experiment, right? So the idea of Pakistan started out as a, you know, for people that are not familiar with politics, as a two-nation theory of a unified Indian subcontinent under the British Raj. And Muslims felt that Hindus have a 3-to-1 advantage. So therefore, we need a separate nation of our own. And so they formulated Pakistan as their own different identity, as Muslims being a separate group of people. So they invented a people. And initially, the regime was actually secular. Ayub Khan was pretty secular. Jinnah, you could argue, was quite secular. This dude, you know, had whiskey, used to eat pork. So he was a very secular guy. And the name of Pakistan was the Dominion of Pakistan, and it got changed in the 1950s to the Islamic Republic of Pakistan. That's when, because in early days, there were a lot of rebellions. So the Pashtunistan movement started, you know, the Bengalis weren't happy, and actually the Bengals separated. So when Bengal separated, East Pakistan separated, that was a big blow, that you can keep Pakistan together just by secular means. And that's when Islamic ideology just came in. Like, so under Ziaul Haq, the Islamic narrative started being reinvented to keep the Muslims together. So Islam then became this Islamic Republic and eventually into a theocracy. So you're right. You know, Pakistan cannot be held together without religion. And that is the unfortunate part about Pakistan, whereas for India, so Nehru's India was actually a secular India, and if we go back, and to be honest, it was the Congress Party that broke Pakistan, because Congress was, I would argue, a fundamental threat to the two-nation theory, because, you know, in Nehru's India, Muslims had a lot of rights. And even today, Indian constitution is quite secular. So the current phase, like, there's a lot of politics going on in India right now, and Muslims feel like a little marginalized. I feel like there are a lot. I will tell you personally what a lot of patriotic Pakistanis feel. They're very happy about Modi, because they feel that Modi is validating the two-nation theory. And that's, we're all over social media. So if anything, I think the subcontinent, my people in the subcontinent, I would say, Hindus, you fight your extremists. Like, you know, and we will take care of our own. If you want the subcontinent to be united and, you know, be open to Central Asia and become a prosperous society and counter the communists. But if that's what you want eventually, you have to stop dividing ourselves further and further, and let's focus on getting rid of extremists. That's what I would say.
We need, and I've been speaking against this as well, because a couple of things have come up. In my last video was about MF Hussein, the painter. about how he was mobbed for some of his paintings, and how I was saying that we need an India, we need a Canada, we need the whole world to be based on secular freedoms and values and not based on religious identities and ethnic identities. We want a world where people are free to be themselves, you know?
Totally. Now, sorry,
do you have something else you wanted to say?
Yeah, regarding this topic, like India is itself an experiment, right? So India is a geographic experiment because the subcontinent was never really united in the past, unless it was under dictatorships or, you know, some kings and the Mauryan Empire, for instance, the British Raj, the Mughals. So India has a better chance in surviving because it's a geographical secular state. And hopefully it remains as a secular state. That's the only way it can survive. So there are a lot of people in India that, you know, I feel like are ridiculing secularism. Like, you know, they call them secular, like S-I-C-K.
Yeah.
So to me, that is disheartening because, to be honest, secularism is the only way India will survive. India is a subcontinent. The Punjabis and Bengalis are not the same people. This is like Germany and France. We are a diverse group of people, speak different languages, and the only way we can survive is by respecting everyone through secularism.
I agree. Absolutely. I hope that, you know, this is the way that we're going to go. And right now things are a little bit willing in some of these countries. But I have some Muslim advice from you. You guys need to accept Islam because it's the fastest growing religion and soon everyone will be Muslim. And this is actually a Muslim. This is not a joke. I thought it was a joke. I'm like, oh my God, this is hilarious. What do you have to say to that?
I mean, Islam today, I have to break it to you that Islam is actually hemorrhaging followers. Hemorrhaging. It's like you have a patient coming in the emergency department and it's bleeding. You need to put an IV right now, stat. You need to call in the nurses. All right, get the crash cart ready. That's what's happening to Islam today. So it's bad, man. It's bad. I see the vital signs going down. The blood pressure's dropping. All right. It's bad. All right. So I wouldn't call that the fastest growing religion. In fact, there are some studies that are showing that in the North Africa and in the Middle East, the young population are leaving religion. In Turkey, they are. And I can tell you from my experience, my generation. So a lot of people like my second cousins have left Islam. They're atheists. They're still in the closet, but they have left Islam. Islam is hemorrhaging followers, and the statistic of the fastest growing religion is only in terms of birth population and so forth, but it doesn't really reflect what people actually believe. I will also tell you that I have coworkers that come from Saudi Arabia, fellow residents, okay? And most residents from Saudi Arabia, in Canada, we have a lot of these residents, Kuwaitis, Saudi Arabians, and so forth. And because the government sponsors them. These people, most of them are atheists. Most of them. I was so surprised. Like, you know, I first of all, I didn't want to say anything because I didn't want to jeopardize my relationship with these fellow doctors. But a lot of them, after talking to them, they were like, no, we don't believe in this.
Oh, wow.
Saudi Arabians, Kuwaitis. Yeah.
Wow.
So I'm very optimistic, my friend. Hussein Hassan.
Yeah, and he also says if my sister becomes an atheist, then she deserves what happens to her. What do you think he means by that?
Deserves what happens to her, like in terms of, I mean, if this is, it could mean like I can't read his mind. Like if he means that there will be an extremist that will target her, well, that is unfortunate to wish something like that to your own blood. You know, like. That's the problem with Islam. That's the problem with indoctrination. It's the problem with any religion. Like, it dehumanizes for the sake of collective ego. It dehumanizes your own family members. And this is the kind of stuff we get in the Quran. You know, Abraham left his father. You know, that is the kind of stuff that is unfortunate. Like, I don't know what to say to that.
And on the other hand, we have a Hindu fellow in the comments who's saying, you know, when I said we want a world of secularism and freedom of religion and all that, he's saying, yeah, a world like communist, atheist, China. What do you think about that? I mean, this is honestly, like, as I've been talking to Hindus a lot recently, based on Armin Nawabi's getting, you know, entrenched in this whole sexy Kali thing, I'm actually leading a lot of things. Like, anyways, I'm not going to say too much about that because I want you to talk about this. But what do you think about this trope of, you know, what atheists want to bring is basically North Korea? And he even said North Korea in another comment. Yeah. Oh, here we go. Oil, atheist, secular North Korea, another great atheist country. Yeah.
I don't know why we have to go to China and North Korea. There are plenty of atheist countries.
Yeah.
Like Sweden has like 80% atheist population. Why can't we look at that? Okay. So, again, we need to realize that humans are different in the sense that we create suprahuman ideologies to keep ourselves united. Okay. So that was that the hypothesis. I don't know if you've ever read Yuval Noah Harari's book.
Yes.
Yeah, and he talks about how Homo sapiens defeated the Homo Neanderthals Homo sapiens. Yeah. And because we had the ability to form suprahuman concepts, myths, and stories that bind people together. Now, communism is a different ideology altogether. So just because you're an atheist doesn't mean that you subscribe to communism. It's an entire political ideology. It's you can call it as some kind of a religion in some sense. You can like Nazism. They in a sense they were worshiping the oligarchy. They were worshiping the Führer. Any type of suprahuman like belief that binds people together, you could define it as some kind of a pseudo kind of religion or atheistic form of non-religious.
Yeah. He got a lot of backlash for saying humanism is like a religion too. A lot of people didn't like that.
Yeah,
I actually agree with him. Sorry to say, I think humanism is a religion. Yeah. I mean, there's nothing wrong with calling it religion and nothing wrong with humanistic religion. My religion is humanity comes first and I care about other people. Like, that's like probably the best religion. Like, if you ask me, if I'm going to become a preacher, hey, like, what better religion can you have than one that cares about your fellow human beings, right? And the well-being of conscious creatures is what matters. So I'm a proselytizer of humanism. I'm sorry.
I'm a humanist too. And you know that we need to accept that we form superhuman concepts all the time. Yeah. And like if Canada, for instance, is another superhuman concept, like you can relate to other Canadians just a fact because of a flag. Yeah. Now, if I burn that flag in front of people, now, of course, I will offend some people. Now, do I have a right to do that? Perhaps I do. You know, I that's my choice.
Yeah.
Now, I can accept, I can probably expect a backlash from that. Unfortunately, what Armin is getting, this is not obviously something that I would do. I believe in like having discussions and bringing people together. I'm not good. Honestly, I'm not good at, you know, like I probably won't be good at stand-up comedy. And so that's not my area. Now, if people like to do that, and that's that, I think it's their right to do that. I'm not saying I'm better than them or less than them. I think they have the entire right to do that. But the kind of response that he has gotten is, I don't know. I think it's expected because I also sympathize because, you know, it is a superhuman concept like any other type of concept. So, but yeah. I don't think people should threaten him or, you know, threaten his life or anything like that. I think that probably goes too far.
Yeah, and this whole thing about like communism is a competing ideology to humanism, in my opinion. Like communism is bad. I don't like communism. And so I like just because I'm atheist doesn't mean like communism. I can like there's humanism, there's communism, there's different belief systems that go on top of atheism. Atheism is just a lack of belief in a god or goddesses and any sort of supernatural.
It's
also known as materialism, right? So we don't believe there's anything outside of this world. So that's just it. It's nothing to do with communism. Like communism is a created system that you may or may not agree with. And I think just like many other systems, it's terrible. I don't like communism. I just think it's bad. If you want to say anything else on communism, go ahead. Otherwise,
I think you summarized it quite well. It's beating the dead horse now.
Okay, great. So can you ask him, Afif Kaja wants to ask, can you ask him why Pakistani blasphemy law is becoming more popular recently and why liberal media groups like Facebook and YouTube support Islam over human rights? I'm just going to say one thing. I think this is happening in India as well, in a sense, because, I mean, blasphemy law is being used even in India to silence critics of both Islam and Hinduism. And like everybody's using blasphemy law. It's just become like a all-out thing. But in Pakistan, it's specifically used against minorities, right? So it's
totally it stems from the British Raj, right, to keep unity in their population. So it makes sense
in India, you mean?
Yeah, in India, in the British Indian. Yeah, so no, Pakistan, it also stems from that too, but then they made it into just an Islamic centric obviously, because it's a theocracy,
everything, right? At least in India, you like, even Christians can use it and even Muslims can use it. In Pakistan, only Muslims can use it.
Yeah, essentially.
And even Ahmadis can't use it because it's used against them, and then like the type of Muslim too, right?
Oh yeah, like Pakistan went to the extreme extent under Bhutto's regime to make them declare them as non-Muslims. And if you want to apply as a, like, you know, Pakistani citizens, you have to sign that you don't consider Ahmadi as Muslim. It's crazy. But in terms of your question, why the blasphemy law is becoming more and more popular, Pakistan has an identity crisis. Okay, so Pakistan has to make itself Islamic to stay together. So if you criticize Islam, the establishment, even though I know for a fact I have like people in my family there in the Pakistani military, okay, I'm not going to say where, but like quite senior members, they are quite secular people, but the establishment has to maintain this whole persona that we are, you know, an Islamic state. And in order to do that, they have to be very rigid about protecting that fabric, because if you don't do that, the entire state falls apart. So if you criticize Islam, it threatens them. And, you know, Imran Khan, who is the prime minister of Pakistan, you know, he's educated at Oxford. He does all these things. You know, he portrays himself as a humanitarian, but he finds himself, I think, powerless to put an Ahmadi in a political group. He tried to do that and he had to retract. He finds himself favoring blasphemy laws. So, and now Pakistan is now obsessed with a Turkic Islamic identity. You know, this whole drama called Erzurum has become very popular in Pakistan. So I don't see, in order to protect the Islamic identity, people will, even though they have what quote unquote liberal Islam becoming more and more popular in Pakistan, this blasphemy law is going to stay for a long, long time, unfortunately, because of the establishment.
That's unfortunate. Sandra is saying it's an economic system. What does God have to do with that? Talking about communism, there is actually an intersection of lack of belief of atheism and communism. And, you know, Karl Marx actually said religion is the opium of the masses. So it is associated with atheism because, you know, communists were against religion as well. And many, like from what I've learned now, many of the atheists or so-called Hindu atheists in India are actually communists. So there is, and even a lot of Bengali ex-Muslims, like they don't even call themselves ex-Muslims. They're not really part of the movement, but they're like ex-Muslims. I shouldn't put it in quotation marks. They are ex-Muslims. They're not Muslims, but they're not connected to a human, like the ex-Muslim movement, at least in Canada and America, like it's a secular human, pro-human rights, humanistic movement, atheist. Mm-hmm. Movement, whereas communism, like the Bengali atheists that I know, they're communist. The it's a totally different thing that they're trying to get, right? And I think from what I've heard, again, I don't know, it could be wrong. So I think that's where some of the connection is coming.
Exactly. It's just you're absolutely right that the Communist Party in India are atheists, and you know they're quite vocal. So it's natural for people to associate communism with atheism, when in fact, atheism is just atheism. You could argue that Buddhism is a type of an atheistic faith.
Yeah.
So, you know, atheism is just the lack of belief in God, essentially. That's it.
Yep. So I've taken a lot of your time, and it was a great conversation, especially the questions at the end. We got a lot of really good questions in there. Would love to have you on another day to talk about something specific, or maybe are you planning to write a book? Because I think you would write an amazing book.
Thank you very much. Perhaps in the future, but right now I'm just focusing on my YouTube channel to create as much reach as possible.
Beautiful. So guys, Abdullah Samir team, go right now to the Urdu Freethinker and subscribe to his channel. And you have videos coming out in English, Urdu. What's the plan?
So it's a bilingual channel. Every video will have an English and Urdu version. So,
Nice. So you're just going to make two audios, but the video will be available.
Absolutely. Yep, absolutely.
So, fantastic. That's a Master Urb style. Actually, you're following the pattern of the Master Urb.
Totally. He's been an inspiration. Absolutely.
Amazing. Amazing. Okay. This has been a blast. I'm going to leave it to you to make the final comments. And just before you do leave your final comments, just one more time, if you're listening to us on a podcast app, please do leave a review. I would appreciate it. And thank you for coming on, Udrufli Thinker. I'm not going to, I know your name, but we didn't discuss having a, do you have like a pen name that you're using, or just Udrufli Thinker?
It's just the Udrufli Thinker. I'm thinking of using a pen name called Azad, which means free.
So oh, I think, beautiful. Azad. Okay, Azad, let's, you have the last word here, and then good night to everyone.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you for everyone being here. I'm really grateful for you to, bringing me onto your platform. It means a lot. And honestly, just stay open, be kind. My channel is all about educating Muslims and non-Muslims about Islam. I try to be as fair as possible. I don't want to create any animosity. There's a lot of negativity in social media. It's all about education. And that's all. Just be good human beings to each other.
Absolutely. That's a beautiful way to end. Thank you, everyone. And we'll see you again another time. Bye.
Bye.